Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the breast center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Anish Chagpar welcomes Dr. Preston Sprenkel. Dr. Sprenkel is assistant professor in the Department of Urology, and here's Dr. Chagpar.
Why don't we start off by you telling us a little bit about prostate cancer?
So prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men, and we have a recent problem with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and their recent findings that recommended against prostate cancer biopsy or prostate cancer screening. And it has been a challenge for urologists because PSA and prostate cancer screening is really the only way that we have to detect prostate cancer. Prostate cancer before screening was detected when men had metastatic disease. It was too late for cure and often too late for really treatment that was anything other than palliative. So with our recent screening efforts, the pressure is on to decrease the morbidity and of these screening efforts and to really treat men appropriately. What we're trying to do then is we have new programs such as active surveillance, which is a non-surgical, non-radiation way of treating men with prostate cancer that is low risk. Before we even get to treating it, though, we have to diagnose prostate cancer. So prostate cancer screening with PSA and a physical prostate exam are still the only ways that we have to be able to diagnose prostate cancer. There are no real symptoms of prostate cancer in its early form that men should look out for or be able to identify. And that's why we continue to stress that screening is a good idea. Once screening with PSA, a blood test or biomarker blood test, or a rectal examination to examine the prostate, identify a suspicious lesion or the PSA is elevated, the definitive step for diagnosis is a biopsy. And prostate biopsy is the only way that we can accurately stage prostate cancer. We have a new device at Yale, which we're pretty excited about. It allows us to take MRI images of the prostate and fuse them with an ultrasound. And when we put these two images together, we can get all the benefits of an MRI, which allow us to identify lesions within the prostate. And over the last several years, MRI imaging has become better and better at identifying these prostate cancer lesions. And we can take that, and instead of then having a patient in a huge MRI machine and trying to do biopsies there, we're able to do it in our office, which is much more comfortable, and use an ultrasound probe, which we use anyway for biopsy. And we can take the images from the MRI, which are better than the ultrasound images in detecting cancer, and fuse them with our ultrasound images. And we can then, in real time, identify the lesions that were visible on MR and biopsy those using our ultrasound. So it really takes the benefits of MR and the benefits of ultrasound and puts those together.
So if you're a guy, let's go back just a half a step. So here you are, you're one of our listeners, and you're thinking about prostate cancer, and the first question that you have is, well, should I even get a PSA test? So your recommendation is to continue to get PSAs because without them, you get advanced disease. Is that right?
Well, not necessarily. So the current recommendations from the American Urological Association, our national body as urologists, and the National Cancer Society are that men should be screened for prostate cancer from about the age of 45 until the age of 75, or earlier if they have less than 10 years of life expectancy. Prostate cancer is a slow-growing disease, and so we don't want to be screening everyone. And that is one of the problems with prostate cancer screening, and that's one of the reasons that the USPSTF made its recommendations, because men who were 30 were being screened without reason, and men who were 85 and only had 2 years left to live were being screened. So there was definitely an overuse of the test. So who should be screened? Men over age 40, if they're African American, or if they have a first degree relative, meaning a father or a brother who has been diagnosed with prostate cancer. Those men should be screened starting around age 40 to 45. Otherwise, age 45 to 50, and until about the age of 75, depending on their health status. And at that point, it has to be individualized a little bit more depending on how healthy someone is.
Okay, so you're a guy, you're 65, you're relatively healthy. So you go to your family doctor, and your doctor does a PSA, and lo and behold, does a digital rectal exam, and feels a nodule. What happens next?
So typically, they then would be referred to see a urologist, and the urologist would repeat the exam and see what the PSA values were. But usually the PSA and the prostate exam are independent of each other. You only need one of those to be positive. So if you felt something abnormal on a prostate exam, it doesn't really matter what the PSA was. Versus if the prostate exam is normal but the PSA is elevated, either one of those is enough that a biopsy can be recommended.
So is your first test at that point, is your first test an ultrasound, or is it an MRI, or what happens at that point?
So imaging modalities are not currently, so MRI and ultrasound are not used by themselves currently to detect prostate cancer. There's not enough experience, and we can't say if there's a lesion that we see on MRI, we can't say, okay, you have this cancer, and we know what the grade is. So they only can be used with biopsy.
Right.
And if an MRI is negative and doesn't show anything, it doesn't mean that there's not cancer there. We don't have enough data or information yet to be able to say that. Our goal is to be able to do that eventually. But an MRI or ultrasound can be used to target your biopsies. So typically, a usual biopsy is done in the urologist's office with a handheld ultrasound. An ultrasound of the prostate is done to measure the size of the prostate to look for anything that appears abnormal on the ultrasound. And it's difficult to read an ultrasound. Abnormalities are not always that common. So what you then do is you use the ultrasound to look where the prostate is and try to distribute random biopsies throughout the prostate using the ultrasound. And interesting, there's a recent study that was out of Korea and Johns Hopkins University that showed that the handheld ultrasound guided biopsy does an okay job, but often the biopsies are clustered and they can miss entire portions of the prostate altogether. So they're random, but they are not evenly distributed throughout the prostate. And they compared this to a robotic arm guided biopsy, which showed a systematic or very even distribution of biopsies throughout the prostate. What we are doing here is sort of a combination of that. So we actually take the MRI images, which are much better at identifying lesions in the prostate, and we combine that with our real-time ultrasound, which is typically what is done, but we have a robotic arm that holds the ultrasound probe. So not only does it help steady the biopsy, it allows us to do that in an evenly distributed way throughout the prostate.
But it sounds to me that this is even better because if I understood you right, and correct me if I misunderstood. So historically, ultrasound helps you to see the prostate itself, but doesn't necessarily help you to exactly visualize where the lesion is. And so you would take these, quote, random biopsies, but if MRI actually helps you to see the target, and now you're able to fuse seeing the target with the ultrasound that you have in your office, one would presume that you now have this way to definitively sample not just the entire prostate, but the actual target right in your office. Is that right?
That is correct. And that is one of the, we feel is one of the major leaps forward with this technology. And in a recent article that was published from a group at UCLA who's been using this device, they found that the targeted biopsies were 3 times more likely to have cancer in them than the random biopsies. So it increases our yield. That doesn't say that that this creates more positive biopsies, but if something is there and was potentially missed before, we are now able to identify that. That's one of the problems with biopsies. If you miss something and things are still abnormal, we do repeat biopsies. So this ideally will decrease the number of repeat biopsies that are necessary, and it definitely, absolutely increases our ability to hit or target and sample the lesions that are identified.
Yeah, because it would seem that that was the whole purpose of the screening program is you screen a guy and you say, you know what, your PSA is through the roof. You know, I either feel or don't feel a nodule. Boy, I'm pretty worried. But then you do these biopsies that are a little bit in the dark if you didn't have this targeting system. But now you're able to say, guess what? I hit the target and this is what it is.
Correct. Yep. So that is definitely a big help in what we hope to do. And we're still evaluating it to see how much better it is. I mean, there are some limitations in that it is an additional device and there is a little bit of training to be able to use it. But we think that it could revolutionize the ability to do a biopsy and really help identify where lesions are and biopsy those lesions that are high risk.
And so is this, it sounds like this is very high tech with the MR and the 3D ultrasound and fusing these images. This isn't something that, you know, I would think you'd find in, you know, your friendly neighborhood urologist's office.
I think there are about 10 centers around the country that currently have it in clinical use. UCLA is one of the oldest. They've been doing these biopsies since 2009. And they're the only group that really has published their results with this specific technology. There are other groups doing MR fusion technology where they take the MR images and fuse it with the ultrasound and do the biopsies. The NIH has had a program there for many years, but they are using a different technology. But again, they're proponents of the same kind of, they see the same results where they're able to target lesions and get much higher yield in the targeted biopsies.
So now are you using this universally on all patients who present to the urology program at Yale?
We are trying to. So we're in the process of implementing that, yes. Right now I'm the only one who's doing them full-time, but the other physicians are. We're in the process of either getting them engaged or having the referrals so that I can do the biopsies for them.
That's fantastic. So have you found that with this technology, now you're when you actually see the lesion that you are getting more positive results so that you are able to get, A, are you finding these cancers earlier? And B, are you being able to treat more men with prostate cancer?
Well, those are good questions. The biopsy isn't necessarily going to help us find cancer earlier. And there's actually a question of, do we want to find prostate cancer earlier in men with low-risk prostate cancer? What we hope and what we see some evidence of is that men who have a high-risk lesion, the men that really where the prostate cancer will likely affect the course of their life, those are the patients that we are detecting with MRI. And those are the patients that we are able to biopsy and identify the prostate cancer. And they don't, even if the prostate cancer is in a difficult location that we wouldn't get on a regular screening biopsy. Those are the people that are really benefited by this.
Well, that sounds excellent. So we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about prostate cancer with Dr. Preston Sprenkel.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year. But there's new hope. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. A potential breakthrough in treating chemotherapy-resistant breast cancer is now being studied at Yale, combining BSI-101, a PARP inhibitor, with the chemotherapy drug irinotecan. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anish Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Preston Sprinkle. And we were discussing biopsies for prostate cancer and some new technology that's being utilized, fusing MRI images with ultrasound and really helping to target prostate cancers. So, Preston, right before we left off, right before the break, I had asked you about whether this targeting technology allowed you to find cancers earlier. And you had said, well, you know, it allows you to more accurately target these cancers, but you don't necessarily want to go whole hog and treat really early prostate cancers really aggressively. So tell me a little bit more about how people who may have a really early prostate cancer are managed and how you use this technology to help you with that.
Sure, thanks. That's a great question too. I think, so prostate cancer is, there's low grade and high grade prostate cancer. We use a Gleason score to differentiate how cancer is graded. And typically the most common and lowest grade that's considered cancer currently is Gleason 6, and it goes up to a Gleason 10. And what we found is that there have been many studies of trials called active surveillance. And this is different than the historical watchful waiting that many patients, parents, or even grandparents had, where watchful waiting was you were diagnosed with prostate cancer, but you were old and sort of sick. So you were told you have prostate cancer and you were sent home until you had symptoms of disease that had spread to the bones and you had pain. And then you'd come back and we would give you palliation with some treatment. Active surveillance is a very different sort of treatment. What we do is we identify patients that have low risk disease. So what that typically means is Gleason 6 prostate cancer in a small amount of the biopsy cores. It can be 5%, it can be 25% of the core. Typically, it's less than 3 cores involved and less than 40% in any one of those cores makes someone a candidate for active surveillance. What we are able to do with these patients is identify those who have a low likelihood of progression of their prostate cancer. And the reason this is really important is prostate cancer is a bad disease, but the treatment is also very bad. In the sense that while we can cure cancer, the side effects such as urinary incontinence and sexual dysfunction are major, and they significantly impact people's quality of life. Good surgical technique can minimize that a fair bit, but still it can happen to a large number of people. Our active surveillance protocol, which we have instituted here at Yale, allows us to identify patients with low-risk disease, a very low likelihood the disease is going to advance quickly, and we can put these patients on active surveillance. So we can delay or perhaps prevent forever them needing definitive therapy and the associated problems with urinary and sexual function. So if you can give someone an additional 5 or 6 years of their normal urinary or sexual function, that's a tremendous advantage over early treatment. And what we've seen in other studies is that there is no decrease that we've been able to identify in long-term survival by doing active surveillance appropriately. Now, active surveillance is, like I said, we're not sending you home. We keep a close eye on the patients. We do a PSA test and a prostate exam, usually about every 6 months, and we repeat biopsies about every 2 years with a possibility of doing it earlier if anything in the PSA or the rectal examination feel abnormal. But by doing this, in general, we're able to keep patients pretty happy with their current sexual and urinary function and allow them to have a prolonged course of their natural life.
So that's really cool. So you could be a gentleman who comes in, got screened, had this MR ultrasound fused targeted high-tech biopsy, mm-hmm. And then told, you know what, your cancer is really low risk. We're going to see you back in 6 months, repeat your PSA, and in 2 years, we'll do the whole high-tech biopsy thing again. If things look the same, well, then they're the same, and you can live with this cancer and know that you're at low risk.
That's correct. And actually, while we do use the fusion biopsy to diagnose this, it's not required that you have that biopsy to be a candidate for active surveillance. Any biopsy could make someone a candidate for active surveillance. So it's not only for those people. We often will repeat a biopsy in around 6 months from the first one, just to make sure that, because it is a random biopsy, that we did not miss anything in the prostate. And by doing that, we are able to confirm that this really is low-risk disease. We feel more comfortable that this is low-risk disease and continuing active surveillance is a good idea. Now, for patients with higher-risk disease, there are very good treatment options, and surgery and radiation are definitely important and should be thought of as treatment options, because they do give very good cure and survival rates. And in those, unfortunately, in those levels of prostate cancer, the risk of prostate cancer affecting their quality of life and longevity of life is high enough that treatment initially, definitive treatment for cure, is recommended.
So you do have this kind of weighing of risk and benefit. What's the risk of the cancer being very aggressive, such that the risk of surgery and radiation and treatment outweighs the benefit that you would get with those treatments? But I want to come back to the targeted biopsy just for a minute in terms of this active surveillance. One of the things that struck me about this targeted approach is that it's harder to miss when you see the target right there, because the MRI sees it so well and you're able to fuse it with the ultrasound. One would think that would be particularly useful in the active surveillance rather than the random biopsy that they may have gotten initially, because then you'd really be able to say, you know what, I know that this is low risk. I know that I'm not missing something by doing a random biopsy.
No, you're absolutely right. And that is one of the benefits of the fusion biopsy, and why, even if someone is a candidate for active surveillance with an outside biopsy, I will repeat a fusion biopsy before they go into active surveillance so that we can follow it. And exactly as you mentioned, we can record exactly where, on a three-dimensional model, our biopsies went. So we can see where prostate cancer was, and we can biopsy the exact same place when we do the repeat biopsies, which is impossible without a technology similar to this.
So now let's talk a little bit, because you mentioned it, about the higher risk people. So if somebody came in, they had screening, and now they actually had a higher Gleason score. So what Gleason score or what criteria would you kind of say, you know what, that tilts the balance a little bit against active surveillance and more towards active treatment?
There are a lot of variables, and a lot of them are personal in addition to just the cancer. So patient age makes a difference. Again, we know that prostate cancer is rather slow growing, especially the low-risk types. Higher risk we think of as more aggressive. But for someone diagnosed in their 70s in the early 70s with a Gleason 7, sort of a low intermediate risk lesion, that's small volume, some people do consider putting and do put those patients on active surveillance, versus a 52-year-old gentleman with a small amount of prostate cancer, or even the same amount of cancer in a 52-year-old gentleman. It becomes difficult because we don't try to put, there's no cookie cutter that fits everyone. And we try to personalize it based on what the patient wants as well. Some people are not comfortable with knowing they have a diagnosis of cancer and watching it and being on active surveillance. They'd rather be assured that everything is done and the tumor is removed, the prostate is removed, and know that they are free of that cancer. While others really are concerned about their quality of life and would rather try to take a risk of having some cancer in their prostate and actively surveilling it. Currently, we do not include many intermediate risk patients in active surveillance. We don't have enough long-term information or understanding yet to think that it's safe to include those people. But in general, to qualify for active surveillance, I mentioned the Gleason criteria, sort of the number of biopsy cores, PSA less than 10, and less than three cores or less involved with prostate cancer. And typically almost all age groups are now considered eligible
for active surveillance.
Yeah.
So if there's a gentleman who says to you, you know, I'm 52 years old, I have a high-risk Gleason score, and I want my prostate out. One of the things that you mentioned before we went to break was that while treatment is associated with some side effects, some of that can be minimized with good surgical technique. And there's a lot of talk out there now about different kinds of surgical technique, particularly for prostate cancer, using high-tech robots and so on and so forth. Is that type of thing available? Are you doing that? How does that play into the paradigm?
There, we do have robotic surgery available at Yale. I do perform robotic surgery. The caveat with robotic surgery is that it is a tool. The robot is not better than a surgeon's scalpel at cutting out prostate cancer. It really depends on your surgeon. And the surgeon's skill level is what's going to determine how good your outcomes are. And that's part of it. It's also, unfortunately, the physiology and just the way the person's body is put together. So we can do the same surgery every time, and people have different outcomes. So most, I think all surgeons do their best every single time they go in there to preserve as much function, both urinary and sexual function, as they can. But the main goal is a cancer operation and to cure the patient of cancer. And the technology, whether robotic or open, is not as important as sort of the skill of the surgeon.
Yeah, I guess that's something that I'm not sure that everybody always understands. We talk about robotic surgery and you think of, you know, R2-D2 or C-3PO, you know, taking out your cancer. But in reality, there's a surgeon running that robot and actually making the robot do what the surgeon wants them to do, right?
Correct. Absolutely. These robots are very high tech, but they're not. There's no artificial intelligence. They don't have their own brain. They are tools. They are a machine that the surgeon drives, and it allows the surgeon to not have his hands in the patient's body, but the extension of his hands, the robotic arms, are in the patient's body. So the main benefit of robotic surgery is that it has a lower blood loss than open surgery. This has been well accepted, and the incisions are individually smaller. Long-term outcomes seem pretty similar between the two. After about 6 weeks, the recovery is pretty much the same. Maybe 12 hours earlier on discharge with robotic surgery versus open. But I can say that having operated with some expert open surgeons and expert robotic surgeons, their outcomes are pretty equivalent.
Dr. Preston Sprenkel is assistant professor in the Department of Urology at the Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.